Hello, I'm Andrew Fuller. I'm the chairperson of Generation Next, a not-for-profit charity which provides for our community podcasts on the latest research and knowledge around helping young people and their families, of course, to create well-being and mental health. In this series, we interview and speak with a great range of experts in different fields, and today I'm just delighted to spend some time again with Marie Fakakis, who is a mental health social worker and the founder of Connecting with Teens program, and also has her own podcast, of course, This Complex Life. And well, Marie, life indeed is complex, but perhaps we won't dwell too much on that today. We're going to talk a little bit about the shifting role of parents and how that has changed over the last couple of fairly momentous years. And then we'll spend time talking about what's useful to say and presumably what's not useful to say to teenagers. And then the fine but sometimes invisible art of listening. And then really thinking about how we might check in on young people as they emerge into young adulthood. So welcome, Marie. It's great to have you with us. The shifting role of parents, what are you noticing?
Yeah, I think I was thinking more around how the role shifts from it, depending on the parents and their child, the age of the children. So one of the things I notice when I work with parents, I mostly work with parents of high school age children, is that feeling of disconnection or confusion around, but they used to need me to do all of these things and they used to love me dropping them off at school and now they won't talk to me or they won't open up. And we kind of have a saying floating around, I have no idea who came up with it, but parents kind of move from being a manager to consultant, and kids love parents in this manager role. It's organizing play dates and excursions and money for the canteen and events at school. And they love it. They want you there for that. And then somewhere between like grade 5 and 6, maybe year 7, sometimes parents get like unceremoniously fired from this role as managers. And parents can kind of respond in a number of ways. Some fight for this, like through litigation for unfair dismissal. And they're like, no, I need to stay in this role as manager. You can't get rid of me. You need me. And they kind of claw in to try and fight for this. And that can be years of conflict. Some will turn around and say, well, stuff it. I don't need you anyway. You don't need me. This is fine. I'm going off my way. But what we really want to try and encourage parents to do is recognize that that's supposed to happen and how to get rehired as the consultant. So this consultant is sort of more of a side by side, or maybe even side by side and a little bit of a step back. And it's more mentoring, guiding, educating, and being invited into that conversation. And I think that's been quite difficult for some people as they've maybe been on top of each other during lockdowns a couple of years ago. Maybe they're seeing their young folk not achieving certain social milestones because of changes to the way, you know, people were socialized for so long. But I think that that line between manager and consultant, it kind of maybe got a little bit blurry. So I guess that's something, that's an analogy that I would use for people to kind of think about. How do you respond? And have you been fired? Did you even realize that that happened? And kind of what you've been doing since, trying to figure out your new position description, I guess.
So some of the teenagers that I work with would regard their consultants as not very good or not very knowledgeable, knowing nothing, really. how do you shape that into the family, do you think?
I think I can see why young people say that, and I hear it a lot. And then I work with parents and I see the desperation in them wanting to get it right and knowing that they're not meeting their kids' needs or not getting it right, being confused as to how. And I think a lot of that comes into how we communicate. So one of the pieces I see missing is often not just young people, but a lot of us, we don't just want the problem to be fixed. We don't just want someone to say, well, have you tried this? Or have you thought about that? Or when I was your age, those sorts of things make us feel maybe stupid. Like, well, if it was that obvious, I would have figured it out myself. Or, you didn't really hear me or understand me. So I think maybe that's one of the pieces that's missing, is young people not feeling like their parents hear them or understand them or give them, have confidence that they have thought of a number of different alternatives, or maybe even just, holding space or giving room for them to just vent without trying to fix it or problem solve. So I think that that's a bit maybe that we're not doing quite as well.
So it's interesting then to think about how do, I mean, obviously language is important in all of our lives. It's the way we often connect. So how do we help parents and sometimes teenagers and children as well to have a better communication style with one another?
I would, and I run a couple of different programs, so I might pinch ideas from all of them, but the one that I have created myself and I'm working on turning it into a book, which is really exciting, is the Connected Teens. It's really thinking maybe first about what kind of parent do you want to be? So especially as they move from primary school to high school, you've got a bit of a chance to reflect on, oh, what kind of parent do I want to be? What kind of relationship do I want to have? And then using that as a bit of a guidepost. So very sort of acceptance and commitment therapy, you know, using values to guide you. So that might be the first step, is actually thinking, do I want to be the kind of parent that has a trusting relationship, a respectful one? What do I value? How do I teach that to my children? Because without that as a bit of a guide or a compass, it can make those other things harder to do. So once you've had a chance to figure that out, and most parents will say things, I want my kid to be happy. It's like, well, that's impossible because we're not happy all the time. So let's put happiness aside and let's think about, you know, respect or a good communicator, or I want them to feel like they're loved and they're valued. That's a really good place to start. And I can give you some prompting questions that if you can put in the show notes or something like that. And then it's thinking about how does that then show up? So if I want a connected relationship, and 5 or 6 out of the 7 days of the week, we're yelling about homework, books, sports clothes, washing, chores. Where's the room for that connection? So we need to start then carving out opportunities to put some of the day-to-day hustle and bustle aside and then find ways to connect. So if you've got a young person that comes home and they throw their bag on the floor, one response might be, pick up your stuff off the floor. That's no way to treat your bag or throw your books around. Another opportunity could be, that's unusual for them. I wonder what they're trying to tell me. So maybe you just let them do that. They go up to their room. You have a moment to take a few breaths. You walk up, knock on the door, ask for permission to come in, and then say, hey, looks like you've had a rough day. So seeing day-to-day opportunities that you might have missed or might have scolded or might have ignored as a chance to connect and have a different conversation. So once you've opened up that door, literally like knock on, come over, it's like you've had a rough day, you've already then started a different kind of conversation than had you gone down the other path of pick your bag up off the floor, don't throw crap here or whatever.
So Maria, it sounds like you're implying, shock, shock, that communication might be more about listening than talking. Is that implicit in your answer or your comments?
Absolutely. It really is. It's listening, to genuinely listen and be curious, not to find an opportunity to jump in next or ask the next question. If you really want that kind of connection, then that's the skill. But also I would encourage parents to remember, in that consultant role, you're teaching your kids what skills they need for then their other relationships. So if you're showing them how to listen, you're showing them how to be curious, through osmosis, through kind of being around that, they then learn how to do that with their friends, with future partners, with colleagues, with employers, employees, whatever. So you can see that as a really good chance to be like, I'm not only doing this for our relationship, but I'm teaching them how to take that skill elsewhere. So that might be another kind of bonus and a chance to kind of think, well, that's my guiding kind of compass. Like if I'm moving towards this relationship and I'm also teaching them how to do this, double tick, that's pretty cool.
And so do you have any particular phrases or questions that are favorites of yours in your courses that you teach?
Yeah, I've got a few that I've jotted down so that I wouldn't forget. But I think the first one is to be attentive. So before we even actually ask particular questions, is, am I scrolling through my phone? Am I flicking through the channel? Am I doing something else that's causing me to be distracted? If you're, you know, like, and I work with some young people where eye contact is really uncomfortable. So we might play a game of Uno or Jenga while they're talking, because that's uncomfortable, but they know that I'm there present for them. But if I'm sitting there cutting onions for a bolognese and I'm kind of wiping away tears because it's, you know, it's onions, or kind of sauteing something, and then the dog's in my face. And if you're doing all of that, it's really hard to have that kind of conversation. So first I would encourage people to think about, how do they show attention? Like, how are they there and present? Phone away, a laptop away, or, you know, any of that stuff. And then the kinds of questions I would encourage people to think about are things like, can you tell me more? It sounds like you've already tried a number of things. Tell me what you've already tried. What are you imagining is the worst thing that could happen right now? What advice would you maybe give a friend? Or do you want to just vent, or do you want me to help nut this out with you? So sometimes those little kinds of sprinkles of questions can help generate a bit more conversation. Because I see sometimes parents, a young person will share something and they're so excited to have that connection that they overfunction. They, oh my goodness, I'm going to call the school. I'm going to tell them about this, and call, and they cause a lot more chaos. And the young person sleeps on it. The next day they're like, oh no, I'm fine. It's all good. It was just a friendship issue. But the parents already sent an email telling the school about bullying. And sometimes they'll email the child's therapist saying, we had this incident and all this stuff has been activated. And the next day the young person's like, oh no, it's all good. So take it slow, ask the right questions, and give them some trust that they've already thought of a lot of stuff too.
So I guess every parent at some stage worries about the well-being of their child, and are they going to be okay? And so at sometimes, of course, teenagers particularly, kids are a bit easier, but teenagers can be incommunicative beasts at times. So how does a parent go about checking that things are all okay, particularly, I suppose, with older teenagers and sometimes emerging adults?
Yeah, I think it's tricky to just magically create that if it hasn't already been there. So wherever you're at now in your relationship, you can start. If you haven't done any of this yet, you can start by building that foundation. Because if you overreact when they tell you about, not getting a grade, a particular grade on a maths test, if you overreact at that, they're not going to be able to talk to you about a friend offering them drugs at a party, or a sexual assault, or something bigger. So you need to start to build a relationship of trust that they can trust you, that you can hold that conversation, that you're not going to overreact. And I had a young person that I was talking to recently. I was like, how did your parents react when you told them this out of 10? It was like a 12. Okay. Firstly, it wasn't a 12 out of 10 response. It was definitely not warranted, but the parents really did overreact. And consequently meant that young person told them less and less. So being able to watch your reaction is a really important step. And if you're listening to this and think, oh God, I got this wrong, definitely own that. You know, remember that bit about we're teaching them how to have these skills in life. So if you've just recently had a conversation, you're like, oh, that was a 12 out of 10 reaction. Oh, my bad. Tell them that. Just say, hey, I was listening to a podcast, or I was thinking about this conversation we had the other day. You tried to share something with me and I lost it, or I completely overreacted. I really want to try that again. Could we have a fresh start? So you can model that accountability and that perspective taking, and that starts to build trust, because we have a lot more trust for someone who takes responsibility for their actions, who shows accountability. And our parents doing that to us, teachers doing that to students, role models that it's okay. It role models the language, and then they're more likely to do it back as well. So kids can't be what they can't see. If they haven't seen respect, if they haven't seen accountability, if they haven't seen honesty, it's really hard for them to do that.
So I'm intrigued a bit by just the thought that under pressure, sometimes parents revert to the sort of parenting that they themselves received, even if they didn't necessarily like that parenting. And for those parents who had themselves parents who underreacted rather than overreacted, I wonder, because of course then the tendency is to almost not be responsive at times when you need to be. And so it's easy to think about the parents who sometimes fly off the handle and become very reactive. But for those who tend to become sort of almost reclusive themselves, the introverted parents, perhaps, or the ones who feel that they're so hesitant that they worry about doing the wrong thing and instead do nothing at all.
Yep.
What sort of suggestions would you have for those sorts of people?
I think it's a really good point because underreacting can also increase certain risky behaviors. So if a young person is trying to get attention from a parent, they might escalate certain risk-taking behaviors or even things like self-harm, because it's like, what does it take for me to get you to notice my pain? So if you're worried about saying the wrong thing, I think that's different to maybe not noticing. I think some ways to start that is actually telling your young person that, saying, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to say the right thing here. That already softens it a little bit, lets them know, it shares that vulnerability and starts to build that respect, right? So it's being able to say, okay, a part of me wants to just scoop you up and tell you it's going to be okay. Another part of me wants to like yell at this kid who just said this thing for you. And another part of me really doesn't want to say the wrong thing. So I'm just going to take it slow. Where should we start? So even maybe owning those different parts of you, those different conflicting maybe sides, and voicing, giving them voice, because it gets the young person thinking, oh, my parent is thinking about this and also this, and they're telling me about this, but they haven't still lost their minds in this conversation. We're still engaged. So maybe giving voice to those parts can be a really helpful step. And if you have gotten that wrong in the past, go back and revisit that, saying, hey, the other day when you did this, I was either distracted or it caught me off guard. What I would have liked to have said instead was this. And then maybe open it up for a dialogue, or saying, you don't need to say anything else, but I just want to let you know I was thinking of you. I felt like you were trying to tell me something important. I didn't react the way I would have liked, and I'm just letting you know I'm sorry. What I've liked to have done was do this. And I'm gonna go downstairs if you wanna, or in the next room, or going off to work, but if you wanna talk about it later, just let me know. So sometimes those small apologies still help.
Sometimes parents, in an attempt to connect with their children, indulge in self-disclosure. Well, when I was young, I did this, or my first girlfriend or boyfriend, or it wasn't that long ago since I was a teenager myself, all those lines. What do you think about that? Does that
why are they lies? You were a teenager once. I think self-disclosure can be really powerful if invited and if used well. So I would speak more generally. So I'd empathize with the feeling. So if you got dumped, instead of saying, when I was your age, I got dumped and this is what I did to get over it, it could be saying, first listening, show empathy, that sounds awful and I know you really like them and it must be so disappointing. And then it could be, oh, look, I mean, I have a few ideas of what might be helpful. Can I share them with you? If they say yes, then say, oh, look, I found going for a long walk helpful to clear my head, or me and my friends went and did this and that was really fun. Or we binged watched this TV show or something. So I think that's different if you ask for advice. But it's empathizing with the feeling, because I think sometimes we can go too far and we minimize. So a young person might be scared about an oral presentation and their parents like, I do presentations at work all the time. It's not a problem. Oh, when I was your age, I also struggled, but look at me now. I'm great and amazing. And, you know, I can do this. They don't speak like that, but, you know. That's the way the young people describe their parents. So that's when it's probably not helpful. But if you were to say, look, I give presentations a lot at work. I actually remember what it's like to feel anxious. Is there anything, you know, I've got some tips that could help. Do you want me to share them with you? If they say no, they'd be like, cool. If you change your mind, let me know. So it's being invited in to share that experience. And we do it even in therapy. Like, we're really encouraged not to disclose too much, but using careful disclosures with a particular message or a particular point, or to normalize something, can be really helpful. So we want to kind of balance that well and think, who's it serving? Is it to get it off my chest? Is it helpful for me because I just want them to know? Or is this what they need in this moment?
So we've covered how parents shift from being managers to consultants, sometimes not very well-regarded consultants, but consultants nevertheless. We've talked a bit about how to crack open a conversation and how communication is more about listening than talking, and how to check in on young people. And also, of course, thinking about the role of self-disclosure. So is there anything else that you would like to add, Marie, about
parenting? I think the move from manager to consultant, I noticed for a lot of parents, without them maybe articulating it, comes with a lot of feelings of rejection. And that's a really important thing to think about. So whether you, if you're in therapy, talk to your therapist about it. If you have a partner, maybe explore that with them or with friends. And really recognizing that when you're feeling rejected, how do you then respond? So if you used to always drop your young person off at school, kid or a kid, and now they're like, no, I want to catch the bus. And a part of you is like, that ungrateful little whatever, or how dare they? If that starts to trigger something for you, and then you start thinking, like getting angry about it or aggressive about it, or maybe you withdraw, so then they feel like they've done something wrong and have to kind of soothe you, that can be really, have a really big impact in that relationship. So I would encourage you to think about, do you feel rejected? And really think about it. Does it come out as anger, as saying things like they're so ungrateful, I did X, Y, Z? Is it sadness? Is it hurt? Does it come out as withdrawal? And then what do you show your young person? Because that's a really important piece to kind of think about. If you're coming at things with a lot of rejection, it's like, oh, but we always used to do this together, and you put on that sad, pouty face, they start to then feel guilty and confused, when often young people are doing what they're supposed to do. They're separating from the family, they're individuating, they're trying to explore who they are and their identity, and they need to be allowed to take some risks, make some mistakes, obviously within boundaries of what's safe and what the family is comfortable with, and not be worried that, oh, if I do this with my friends, my parents are going to be sad because we used to spend Friday nights together. So I think it's really checking in with you as a parent. A lot of the work that I do with young people is actually parent work, and really thinking about the kind of person you want to be, your own emotions, how you contain those, your interpersonal skills, and trusting your instincts as well. Parents actually know a lot more than they give themselves credit for, and I think there can be so much hype and confusion and misinformation out there. So bring it back down to you, your values, the kind of relationship you want. Take it slow and start to kind of think about those things a bit more intentionally.
So if people would like to continue this conversation with you, Marie, how would they get in contact with you?
Yeah, so for kind of counselling, mental health support, I have my practice in Melbourne, the Therapy Hub. We see adolescents, young adults, through to adults, online and face-to-face. I have my podcast, This Complex Life, which is wherever people get their podcasts. And then my website, marievakarkas.com.au, is where I kind of post upcoming events, trainings, workshops. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. So wherever they want to find me. And I post out a weekly newsletter as well with different well-being tips, reflections. And I think I'm working on, hopefully it'll be ready by the time this goes live, a little ebook on My Teen Won't Listen to Me, ways to connect with your teen. So keep an eye out for that too.
Thank you so much for your time today. I want to honor the work that you do. I think it's wonderful. Thank you, Marie.
Likewise.
Find more resources for supporting the mental health and well-being of young people on the Generation Next website. While you're there, consider becoming a member of the Online Learning Hub, where you can access practical sessions from leading experts on demand. There are many sessions available in the ever-expanding learning library, and each session has an instantly downloadable certificate of completion, which you may even be able to use to claim professional development. You can also feel great about your membership, with all proceeds supporting Generation Next's not-for-profit initiatives, including this podcast. You may also like to read more in Generation Next's Young Minds books. Both books contain practical and easy-to-read chapters on a range of topics from Australia's leading practitioners. Andrew Fuller's chapter, What is Resilience and How to Do It, is in the book Growing Happy, Healthy Young Minds, available on the Generation Next website at www.generationnext.com.au. We hope you found this podcast helpful. Please share this podcast and your learnings with others. Until next time, thanks for listening, and for all you do to support young people and our communities.